podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's the Autosport Podcast. We look ahead to the first day of pre-season testing with Gary Anderson and ask what's gone wrong for Williams. Formula One 2019 is about to get serious. We've seen the new cars in the various launches over the past few days, but on Monday, Barcelona Circuit de Catalunya will finally get to see the cars run. Well, most of them. Anyway, I'm your host, Ed Stewart, and joining me to look ahead to testing is Gary Anderson, who currently luxuriating on the very pleasant sofa in our mansion not far from the circuit.
Yeah, it's all about to kick off, really. It's very interesting, really, because obviously the changes this year, you could say they're small, not massive changes, but they're very subtle and very important changes to the cars. It's interesting what we've seen so far from the cars, that of the different arrangements in the front wing area. And it's going to be really, really quite difficult to know without seeing the cars perform as to who's got it right. But because we've got Mercedes gone one way with have what you might call a conventional five-element wing, and Red Bull, more or less the same, and then we've got the Ferrari has gone for this wing that dips off as it goes out to the front wing end plate. So those three top teams as such, it's going to be quite interesting to see who's got it right, because somebody somewhere has missed the point a little bit, and it's one of them's going to have to change.
What's your gut feeling?
I don't know how you can produce the front downforce without having the components there. Producing front downforce in front of a rotating tyre from a section and wing there is quite difficult. And the wing is limited to five elements, so you've got to be really careful with how that flow changes with the steering lock, because the front wheel's on the move all the time. It's not just in a straight line, it's going around the corner. So it is quite difficult to produce efficient downforce in that area. But if you don't have the bits there, you're not producing any front downforce in that area. And as we know with these tyres, they've always responded to more load. That's one of the reasons the Mercedes, that's one of the reasons the top teams have been better, is because they have bigger facilities, more people, more budget. They can build a car that produces just that bit more downforce, which then means you get a better return from the tyre. So grip level just goes up exponentially as such. So you need to put the bits in the car to produce that downforce. Now, I don't think with this Ferrari-style wing or the Sauber-style wing as it is, and even Renault a bit, I'm not sure. Well, Sauber's not Alfa Romeo, but I'm not sure that you can actually produce the front downforce required.
The argument is, obviously, in that configuration, you can generate enough of an outwash. Do you think that with that reduced amount of front wing componentry as you move towards the end plate, that they can still get enough of outwash from that? Presumably that's the idea, that there's some mechanism that makes that powerful enough to do it.
Yeah, and it's all, you can see it and you can understand it to a certain level, but the thing for me is the front wing has been made 10 centimetres wider each side this year. It's 20 centimetres wider overall. So basically the end plate lines up with the outside of the front tyre. So instead of having to really be aggressive with that, with turning that airflow in front of the front tyre out around the wheel, you don't have to be so aggressive because the end plate's further out. So the airflow wants to go around the outside of the front tyre itself, because the airflow is trying to go around the outside of the front tyre and connect that with the low pressure in behind the front tyre. So it's sort of trying to fill the hole that the front tyre is making in the airflow as it goes through the air. The philosophy would have changed if the FIA had just allowed a wider front wing for this year and forgotten about doing away with all those bits and pieces, those bits of turning vanes. I think those bits of turning vanes would have disappeared anyway. So I'm not quite sure why this change has been that you have to drop the flaps off going outboard. So as I say, it's going to be very interesting to see, because again, the steering angle of the front wheel changes the front wing performance dramatically, whether the wheel's going in or out on the front wing. So I'm really excited to see it. And Barcelona's great because turn one, turn two and turn three, you know, you need a good front end. The car has to change direction very good. And also in that long, fast right-hander, turn three, the front end's got to stay in or else you just will run out of road. So let's see who's got it right and who's got it wrong. And it'll show up pretty quickly, I think.
But it does seem strange. You make the point about the not being able to generate as much front downforce. They might be able to from kind of reducing the front wing area, but when they set the rules with the wider front wing and it's also a little bit deeper, one of the arguments for doing that was they wanted to make sure that teams could generate enough front end downforce despite the simplification of the front wings and the kind of elimination of what might be called the forward furniture that you won't now see each year. So that just doesn't seem to tally with what they're doing. If they were worried about not being able to generate enough, and now you've got teams willfully giving up a certain amount of wing area there.
I suppose, you know, what I'd like to sort of say, I suppose, is initially, I've never seen such a big difference between two top teams. You know, whenever you consider that last year, Ferrari and Mercedes were nip and tuck as far as circuit performance was concerned, speed was concerned, most of the season. Sometimes Mercedes were better, sometimes Ferrari were better. But in general, you know, when they got their cars together, both of them got the car working correctly. They were pretty close. And, you know, the philosophy of the cars is quite different. You look at this underskirt and the fin on the Mercedes underneath the nose, you know, the different stuff on it. But the basic philosophy of the car and how it was generating outwash front wing end plates, a vortex at the what we call the Y250, the barge boards are very intricate, helping seal the underfloor, blah, blah, blah. All that stuff was working to different degrees, but to the same end result. Whereas now, with this little change on the wing of being wider and, as you say, removing all that furniture, that's all gone. If you consider that, you know, last year's wing, and I'll use an odd number here, you know, last year's front wing was probably made out of something like 101 components. And the one is because the central section in the middle is an FIA-defined part. If you take this year's front wing, it's actually made up of probably 31 components. So there's, you know, like 70 components, 70 turning vanes, or, you know, some sort of a thing has all gone missing off that front wing assembly. And then for the concept of the front wing to be so different, and everybody works from where they were, you know, nobody will sort of try to reinvent the wheel. They'll come in from where they were last year. They'll change the bits and pieces on the car, the regulation changes as such. They'll see how that affects the airflow around the rest of the car, and they will then react to that and optimize bits and pieces. And to see two teams that last year were nip and tuck actually getting to a point where they've gone such a different route is very interesting for me.
That's going to be really interesting areas to see what front wings are going on and off the cars. We did think with some of the cars that were launched, even before we saw these more extreme examples, that we would see, clearly these were very much launch-spec front wings for some teams.
Yes, I mean, we don't know yet. Let's wait a little while and see who does what. I mean, maybe Mercedes and Red Bull will appear with a Ferrari-style wing tomorrow when they first run the car, and that was just some old bits they had lying around to put on it to make it look good. But I don't think so. And if I was sticking my neck out right now, I would have said that the Mercedes Red Bull, the more conventional front wing design as such, is the one that's going to produce the end result.
Well, the good thing is we won't have too long to start to find out, because testing does start off tomorrow. Obviously, Autosport's out here in force. You'll be hearing from me and Gary each day. And you might be able to hear in the background some various clunking around. That's Scott Mitchell doing some cooking for us. And there's a kitchen table full of people doing work, video projects being put together. There's our technical editor, Jake Boxall-Legg, looking at various images of things. So an interesting one to talk about now, a bit of news. We've had that Williams won't be running on the first day of testing. It's obviously also a useful way to think about what teams have been doing in terms of preparing to get to the first test. Williams were meant to do a filming day by way of a shakedown, which would have been this weekend, so that should already have been done. So they're missing the first day of testing. We have to say, I guess at this stage, the first day of testing at least. They do say they're going to be out Tuesday. With only 8 days of testing, that's quite serious. So how does it go wrong? How does a car build? What might crop up that would lead Williams to be in this position without having to give up, well, an eighth of their testing pre-season?
Well, we often hear, you know, it's from teams about success being about procedures and making sure your company operates efficiently, and communication within it is good, and you know everybody's working to an end result, and that's exactly the same as trying to get a new car built. There's so many parts coming together from different directions, and at different, you know, manufacturing times. So, you know, one part will take a few hours to make and one part will take a few weeks to make. So that's all got to be planned. And that plan's got to start like 6 months ago and kicking into place. And the one thing you do want to make sure is that you have all the bits in a big pile as late as possible. You know, you don't want sort of the front wing flaps sitting there for 3 weeks, because that means you've just stopped 3 weeks early on developing them. So you want everything to pile into the workshop in a big pile. The guys start putting the car together from the inside out, and the last bit that arrives is the wing mirrors, you know, because that's the last bit you need. And that all has to be planned over a period of time. And that's a procedure that obviously we've seen Mercedes have been able to manage it. They've got their car out, did their test day at Silverstone, or their filming day, whatever they call it. Red Bull did the same. You know, the other teams are close to the mark, but, you know, even Alfa Romeo have got out and done it. Ferrari have done it. So the cars have run, or the majority of the cars have run. Force India, as it was, it's now Racing Point. They've struggled a little bit in getting it all together, but as far as I know, they are going to be together to start tomorrow testing. And unfortunately for Williams, it just shows that there's still things missing there. Yes, they've tried very hard over the winter to build a better car than they had last year. So has everybody. That's the thing. But you've got to achieve your goals, because it's the same as you start developing and you're starting to introduce bits and pieces. You know, if you've got a new front wing coming for Barcelona and it misses it by a day, it arrives on Monday morning after Barcelona, again, you've missed another race with that new development stuff. So you have to get those procedures in place that make it happen. And, you know, you've got to make sure that you don't miss these days, because one day out of eight is a huge loss. You can try and make all that up, but in reality you can't make all that up. You know, you can shorten your program that you set out to do, but you'll never make up for it. So it's a loss to them, and that's a bad way to start the season.
It's a big concern for Williams, isn't it? Because they've got a lot of work. So we have seen in the past teams like Red Bull a few times, and we're going back 5, 6, 7 years, wouldn't have the new car at the first test, but that was when there were more pre-season tests, more test days. Like you say, it's always tight for everyone. All teams talk about how difficult it has been to get the car from running, but they usually make it. And so this suggests to me that something's gone wrong for Williams, and whether that's in terms of their schedule originally was optimistic and wasn't deliverable, or whether something's cropped up they've had to tackle. The fact that they were originally aiming for this shakedown, which means they're a few days out, suggests to me that probably something has cropped up they're having to troubleshoot.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I say. You have to sort of monitor this stuff every day. You know, there's everything that's happening should be at a certain point. So you're not waiting to see if a thing comes in the door the day before the car's bolted together. You know, you should have known a week before that, oh, we're having a little bit of trouble with this part of it here. It might take us an extra hour. And you find a way to overcome that little problem. If you wait till the thing doesn't come in the door, then you're far too late. So yes, there's something's popped up that's caused them a grief. And I'd say all these, you know, like for example, all these suspension components will be drawn, they'll come in, and the first ones will be put in a rig, and they'll be tested to see that they meet the design loads and that they're strong enough to use on the track. And that's one of the things that makes the cars much, much more reliable these days than in the old days. You know, we used to stick our finger in the air and hope. Whereas now you've got the tools and the information to sort of be able to test all that stuff before it gets to the track. Maybe something like that's failed and, you know, they've had to go back and readdress it. So it's not missing the day for a wrong reason. It's missing a day for the right reason, because something's gone wrong. So it's better to regroup and fix it at the beginning than putting on someone that might be, not good enough for the job and it failing. Going around turn three and you end up in the barrier and destroy your car, and then you miss the next 4 days. So it's better to miss one day. But there has to be a genuine reason for it, and they have to realise that genuine reason, and they have to try and fix it so it doesn't happen again.
It's going to be interesting to monitor their progress, and obviously hope they do get the car out for the second day of testing, because sometimes these things do have a tendency to creep on, don't they? And it suddenly we might be out Tuesday afternoon, or then suddenly it rolls onto Wednesday, so that Williams need to get that car out and running. Because it's very important, this early running, isn't it? Some teams have already shaken down on a filming day. Mercedes have, Red Bull have, Toro Rosso, Alfa Romeo, to name a few. Renault were running on Saturday at Barcelona. So what's the first what does the first day of testing look like for teams? I mean, both those who have already done a shakedown and those who might be running the car for the first time.
Well, you know, your first running really is all about making sure all the systems on the car work properly. You know, the oil system, the water systems, all the cooling, the water flows. You know, there's so complicated that you just got to make sure that everything is doing what it should do. And if not, then you got to address why, because it's just, it can be just, you know, something that's, you know, not allowing the water flow to work correctly, and then suddenly you've got a little bit of overheating or a point in the radiator where you've got potentially an airlock and you can't get the flow through it.
Small. Rubens Barrichello can't change gear in one of your cars?
Yeah. Like didn't change gear, but you know, that's a safety feature. Basically, there's two notches on the steering column. The first one, nothing connects up electrically, so you can put the steering wheel on, but nothing, the steering wheel doesn't work. Goes on to the second notch, everything connects up and all works properly.
Which car was that?
It was a 194, Jordan 194.
I guess it's nice, a nice easy fix at least.
Well, yeah, basically what happened was that the steering wheel, although it was pretty hectic at the time, stressful, but the steering wheel hadn't gone into the second notch, but it had nearly gone into the second notch. So all connected up. He got first gear and whatever, drove out of the garage, but just with driving off, the steering wheel slipped back that 5 millimeters into the first notch, the safety notch, so it wouldn't fall off and it still steers a car, but you can't do anything more electrically. So basically, it just as a safety feature, drove in and we reached in and pulled the quick release mechanism, pushed it on, and away he went. It was a big relief. But those things do, you know, things can happen. But basically, if you're starting to run your new car, first thing you want to make sure is all the systems work correctly and that the data you're gathering, because there'll probably be, you know, like, let's say 100 different sensors and extra sensors on these cars at the moment to pick up little points through the radiator systems, through the oil systems, of flow and probably temperature, just to make sure, as I say, everything's working the way you designed it as such. There'll be a lot more aerodynamic sensors on the car. The underfloor will all be little taps, pressure tappings on the floor, so they can measure the performance of it. The front wing's probably going to be the same. So the cars will be going out and they'll be gathering data as such, both for the normal reliability of the systems on the car, but also to make sure that the underfloor and the front wing is working, because that's the most difficult part of a racing car. It's the bit that's near the ground. It's the bit, the car's always moving. The ground surface changes how it all works. So you cannot simulate that 100%. You can try as best you can, but to just get it to correlate with what's happening on the track is quite tough. Even the temperature changes, the ground temperature will change how it works. So you want to try and get a sort of graph of how that's all working, and if that correlates with what you think it should be doing, then you're on your way, you're happy. But there's no point in running a car around in a circle these days and trying to think that you understand it without actually having the data, because there's so much development work going on back at the factory that if suddenly what you think should happen to that car on the track isn't happening to that car on the track, it can completely change your development direction. So you've got to make sure you know the facts of how your car wants to work. And like going back to Williams and not want to harp on at them, but you know, last year they had their problem with the back of the car that the airflow wasn't reattaching on the diffuser, and the car was very nervous to drive at the beginning of the year. They never really got on top of it. And the same with McLaren. McLaren, you know, they believe their car lost a lot of downforce mid-corner with steering lock. But it was doing that at the beginning of the year, and they never really got on top of it. You know, it's a nervous car to drive. But you've got to recognize that early on, and then you can direct your development path to fix it. So those first early tests, will be trying to understand that your car is doing what you think it should do, and that all the systems within the car work properly. And then you'll get into some more performance running later on.
And on the first day of testing, we know that when it comes to lap times, any lap time in testing is heavily caveated with fuel loads, track conditions, tyres, programs, all manner of things. So they're always very difficult to interpret anyway. But can you read anything into the first day if you're just looking at lap times and laps completed?
Yeah, out on the track, I think you can. I mean, the what I call the sort of stance of the car, you can pick that up quite quickly. And the consistency of the car, as long as the guys are doing more than one lap.
This is where you can kind of see the on-track dynamics of the car.
Yeah, you just see how the car, you know, how can it clip the curb every lap? You know, is that what he's doing? Is it one lap he's clipping the curb and the next time he's half a metre away from it or whatever? And also the way the car reacts and turns, and you know, as a rear nerve, you can see all those things, the rear being nerves, and you can also see the, you know, if the car's heavy or not. You know, the agility of the car comes with load. You put an extra 100 kilograms of fuel in the car, or as it would be, probably 70 kilograms extra, because most of them will run with 30 kilograms or whatever, and they'll go up to 100 to see what happens to the tires with the, you know, high fuel loads. So you got a difference in 70 kilograms. You know, that's a monumental thing on one of these cars. That's 2 and a bit seconds of just lap time.
It could be even more with 110 kilos.
Yeah, it's just you know, as I'm saying, you're always running something in the car, so you're not putting just from nothing to 110, but at least you're going to look at 2.5 seconds, maybe 3 seconds of difference in the car, and that 3 seconds of difference is lost in each corner. You know, that's the thing about it. It's not lost coming down the straight. It's lost on acceleration, yes, but it's also lost under braking. But so it's braking for each corner and accelerating out of each corner, so you can see if the car's lively or not lively. So I think not as many of the teams go out on the track as I would like to see, because I think you can see things. You can see things that are happening with your car, as opposed to just listening to the driver or looking at the data. I think you can visually pick up how difficult, or and even just to compare to other cars, because you're not getting the data from other cars. You're getting the data from yours, and you're making all your assumptions based on your car. If you just compare yours to another car, you can see what the flow's like, how the car sort of reacts to the driver and stuff. And I think it's very valid to go out on the track and have a good look.
You do sometimes see team personnel go out. I know sometimes there's team personnel go out with things to listen to other cars to work out what's going on. But you will sometimes see people going out, team members, just have a little bit of a look at it. Sometimes you see drivers out trackside just to have a bit of a look at what the other driver's doing when they're...
Yeah, the thing I'd say about that is you've got to do it fairly consistently. You've got to try and get your eye in with it. And I'll go back a long time. It was whenever Ralf Schumacher drove for us in 1997. And at turn 10, as they come at Barcelona, coming down the back straight as such, and there's a left-hand corner. It's a bit different now, but it's still a left-hand corner. And I was out watching the outside of the track there, and I had my radio on with the pits and just having a look at the cars. And, you know, I heard him coming down there and watched him a few times, and he was coming into it. And the rear of the car was a bit nervous, so he'd just turn in that little bit earlier and that little bit gentler. And then he'd have some understeer in the middle of the corner. And he went back into the pits to his engineer, and who was actually Rob Smedley at the time, and said to Rob, you know, got too much understeer in the car. And I said, on the radio, I heard this, and I said, spoke back to him. I said, I'm not sure you do. I said, I don't think you've got too much understeer. I think it's the rear of the car is nervous because you're now creating the understeer yourself. And I suggested to stiffen the front of the car up so they could brake deeper into the corner, basically. And they did that, come out and drove down into the corner, and lo and behold, no understeer. But it was only because he could brake later and turn the car harder and get more of the corner taken initially, rather than going into the middle of the corner and then having lots of steering lock on. So, you know, you can see things, as I say, and the driver drives the car. A good driver will pick up what he's got and get the best out of it for a lap time. And if that lap time is faster than the previous lap time, then he's done a good job. But if you drive the car in one manner all the time, then you need a car that suits that manner. That was something that, like Jenson Button, Jenson had a way of driving the car where his mid-corner speed was quite high. But he didn't, you know, he didn't brake late and sort of make a sharp corner out of it. He made a flowing corner, a bit like you need for F3. And if the car suited his driving style, he was very good, very quick. But it can't always suit like that. So I think a driver needs to go out, adapt to what he's got, and then you look at the stopwatch and say, is that faster or slower? And you take it from there. But that's a fine line, because you can also be creating your own problems. So you've got to be very disciplined to know when you've had to alter your driving style to suit the car setup. And as to whether it's faster or slower and better for the tyres or worse for the tyres. So there's a lot to do in testing, and somebody out there with a keen eye can usually spot some stuff.
I think the encouraging thing for tomorrow, if the weather's like it's been today, it's a lot warmer than it was last year. I remember it was freezing last year. I remember watching on the first day, it looked like the Toro Rosso had no front end grip at all, because they just couldn't get the front switched on at all. So we should at least see, you know, these aren't representative conditions, but less unrepresentative perhaps than we saw 12 months ago. It snowed on one day of the first test last year.
No, it's definitely a step better than last year for them. And as I say about the stuff near the ground, the front wing and the diffuser and the underfloor and the bottom of the barge boards, all that area, that is all very, very sensitive to you know, ground height and to temperature. And the hotter it gets, if you've got a little problem with it, the hotter it gets, the worse it will get. Yeah, I've had cars where we come winter test in Barcelona and they've been fantastic. Drivers just been raptures about them. And you go to the first race in Australia, you just wonder, this isn't the same car. You go then to Malaysia as it used to be, you think, what happened? What did I leave behind? You know, because this isn't the same car as we tested in Barcelona with. And that's just because the temperature's gone up and your little problem that was, you know, a 5% problem is now a 40% problem. It's just because the temperature changes, the ground temperature changes, you know, everything's different. You know?
The big interesting thing will be the battle up the front. You've got Mercedes and Ferrari, so comparing those two is going to be fascinating. But I think one of the big talking points will also be Red Bull Honda. So what are you hoping to see from that package? Are you assuming it's going to be mechanically and aero-wise a strong car, and then just see where the engine is? How excited are you about seeing it?
I like their car. I think Adrian Newey, as an aerodynamist, is probably one of the best in the pit lane, or is the best in the pit lane. I would like to think that their car will be a good package and will do the job. And I would also love Honda to get there. Now, I don't think they'll get there as an out-and-out Mercedes beater, but I think we saw in the last couple of years that on occasions the Red Bull could make up for its deficit with a Renault engine. How big that deficit was, I don't know. They were very vocal about the deficit to the Renault engine. They're very vocal about the fact Honda hasn't got that deficit. So they've put themselves in a position right now where they should be going out and being competitive with Mercedes and with Ferrari, because that's what they've said as a team. Verstappen, after his shakedown, was you know, very, very happy with everything the way it went. So I think that can be. I think they can be up there on more occasions than they were, but I don't think Honda will be able to do it consistently as far as, and reliability is the wrong word, I suppose. You know, just this three-engine thing for the season is tough for anybody. And I think they will be trying, they'll be taking the long approach. They'll be looking a bit further down the road. You know, they know they've got ground to make up. They've still got ground to make up to be as good or the best engine in the pit lane. And I think they'll put their early period with Red Bull and Toro Rosso into making sure they're getting there with it, knowing that a championship challenge means that you've got to be there every race, all the time, and that might be getting put off for another year. But I'd like to think that if they didn't come away with some wins this year, and I'm talking, you know, three or four wins, five maybe, if they didn't come away with that, I think they would all consider that this year was probably a bit of a waste of time. That won't win them a championship. I doubt very much if it would even look like winning the championship. But they've got to shut down the points gap a bit to those top two, the big two, and show that they can win races on you know, more often than they have done with the Renault engine.
You've been quite positive about the Red Bull car. So is that the car, the ones you've seen? I mean, you haven't seen any of them in person as yet, but is that the one that looks the most impressive, shall we say? I know it's always difficult to judge when you're just going from images.
It's very difficult to judge. My only thing I would say about it is if you give Adrian Newey a bit of a challenge that he can get his teeth into, then I think he'll get his teeth into it and do a good job. And I think at the minute he is inspired to try to, because of Honda coming in, because it's like a new lease of life for them there. You know, we talk about them being a privateer team. They are, when they've got Honda engines, but you know, they're the closest to a works team of the rest, other than Mercedes and Ferrari, the closest to a works team in reality. They've got big budgets and all, you know, big facilities and big people and, you know, all that stuff. So the car, again, it's the devil's in the detail, and we haven't really seen the detail close enough on any of the cars. If I was to stick my neck out and say the car that from pictures that I saw that I thought was the most complete, it would have to be the Mercedes. But that's only because I could see it a bit better. It was easier to sort of pick up stuff on it because it's not that far adrift from what it was before, so you understand it a bit more. Whereas all the rest of them have gone off, you know, off the beaten track a little bit. You need to see it in more detail.
I think it's going to be interesting to see the Alfa Romeo Sauber as was, not just for the front wing, but there's obviously a lot more money around that team than there was. They made really impressive strides last year. So I think we're quite excited. We have seen the shots from it testing at Fiorano, but to get a good look at that car and see how intricate it is and what it does, going to be very interesting, because that's a car and a team that's got the potential to really cause a stir at the front of the midfield.
It is, yeah. My only worry about it is that Kimi is a driver that is excellent. He loves driving racing cars. But it's a bit like Jenson Button. He's got one way of driving. If the car doesn't have the front end that he needs, you know, positive front end and good feedback from the front end, then he's just lost. If he gets understeer with the car, he's lost in the undergrowth of it all. Just, it's happened so many times with him. So if the car suits Kimi, then I think they can do very good things, but they could lose themselves very easily with the car not quite suiting Kimi at the minute. So we need to wait and see how testing goes and what happens with these front wing assemblies, because without doubt the Alfa Romeo one's the most extreme of this, minimising the flap area in front of the front tyres that there is in the pit lane. So we have to see which direction that all takes, because as I say, I just don't understand how you create the downforce without having the bits and pieces there to work that airflow.
We've talked a fair bit about the cars. You just mentioned Kimi Räikkönen there. There's a lot of drivers in unusual places. Daniel Ricciardo going to Renault, for example. Lots of people moving around. We've got influx of new drivers. Antonio Giovinazzi in the Sauber driver, who you've been quite positive about in the past. Is that something you're going to be keeping much of an eye on, how certain people get on? Charles Leclerc at Ferrari is a big one. Can you draw much from pre-season testing about how people are fitting in with teams? And can you see differences between drivers within the same car as to who's more comfortable and who's settling in?
Yeah, I think you will see that. I mean, we got quite a nice sort of bunch of comparisons. You know, whenever you look at the Renault team, for example, Nico Hülkenberg and Ricciardo, two very competent drivers. And then we got McLaren, which has got Carlos Sainz, who drove for Renault last year. So him against Hülkenberg was, again, a bit tit for tat. Hülkenberg might have just had that little bit on him, but not much. So we'll get good comparisons between drivers and teams. And also then we got Lando Norris at McLaren against Sainz, a new boy coming into town. So I think all the way through the grid we can see sort of comparisons of available. Sergio Perez at Force, not Force India.
Force Point.
Force Point,
point, Racing Point.
Racing Point. Yeah, just Sergio Perez at Racing Point. And then, you know, he's joined by, what do you call him? Stroll. So, you know, that's a nice comparison. Is Stroll good enough? I personally think he's quite a good driver, and he's been abused a little bit, and he's gone through a tough time in his 2 years, and his dad's a very rich person and all that stuff, but that's really not his fault. So it'd be nice to see him against Sergio. So there's lots of nice little comparisons within there. The only team, I suppose, and drivers that we can't just get the comparisons on is the two top ones, the Mercedes and the Ferrari at the minute, because we've got, you know, Mercedes have been out on their own against the Mercedes teams, and Ferrari have been out on their own against the Ferrari teams. So we've got Vettel against Leclerc. I think Leclerc's very, very good. I think on days he'll make Sebastian Vettel scratch his head a little bit. And then we've got to see if Bottas can start to push Hamilton a little bit. But I think you'll always see a driver getting the flow, getting the team behind him that little bit better. Just the momentum gets behind one driver as, you know, the first three or four races happen. But I think Barcelona's a good track, because we'll see car comparisons and we'll see driver comparisons from day to day, because they'll be driving the same car as such, you know, one day and one the other day, or even half days. Some of them split the day in half and do it that way. So we do get fairly good comparisons fairly quickly.
And looking at pre-season testing as a whole, teams always like saying, oh, well, we'll wait and see what happens till we get to qualifying in Melbourne. And of course, once you've had qualifying in Melbourne, they say, well, we'll wait and see until Bahrain. Then it's, well, we'll wait and see what happens in Spain. But teams do have a pretty good idea of how things are shaking out in pre-season testing, don't they? They're, in fact, even tomorrow, they'll start to get a bit of a feel for if they've got a good car, bad car, if they're upbeat about things, a bit downbeat. You know, all with the data they've got and the knowledge they'll have of their programs and what other people are doing, testing does tell not the whole story, but more the story perhaps than people make out.
It does. The thing you've got to be sort of wary of, is the fact that most teams will have a reasonable development plan in place for, you know, the Thursday in Melbourne. So this is very important. This stage is very important to recognise your car's problems and make sure your development plan is in the direction of fixing that. So it's going to be down to who's got that best plan in place and how it fits with the car problems that you've got here. But it's the same old deal, you know. If you've got a quick car, you can't hold it back. You know, any time that we've had a good car, from when the driver can go do five laps on it, it comes back in, there's a smile there, there's just a satisfaction that says, oh, this is doing what I wanted to do, you know. And go way back to the Jordan 191. You know, John Watson drove it the first time at Silverstone. And when he came in, he said, it's just lovely to drive. And that doesn't mean it's going to be a race-winning car, but it just means that it's all functioning together. And if you can get the sort of driver satisfied, it's very important. And the Braun in 2009 with Jensen, you know, first test at Barcelona was the same. It just sort of, you know, first time in the pits, it's just a smile. Because you know that, you know, it responds to the steering. You hit the throttle, it doesn't spin the wheels, it's not nervous, you know, all that stuff. And as I say, a good driver during a practice session or a test session will actually know if the setup change they've just done is all right by like turn two on their outlap, just because of the change of the feeling in the car. And it's just such a big thing to them. It's such a tiny thing. We talk about, you know, a tenth or two tenths of a second, like a lifetime, and it is. But to the driver, you know, that's minutes. You know, he feels that. It's just massive. The problem that he's got that creates that two or three tenths of a second loss is massive to him. So the minute you get a little change on it, he'll know on the way out of the pits that it's, yeah, this is responsible.
And what's it like if things are going bad, if you know you've got a problem? How long does it take that to kind of sink in? Is there always that, oh, it started a bit shaky, but it's all right, we'll sort this and this, it'll be fine? But what do you go through when you realise you've got a bit of a battle, and then maybe as you go through testing, things aren't starting to come to you and cars not responding to setup changes, and you realise you've got a little bit of a battle heading to Melbourne?
Well, again, you know that just as quickly as you do the good parts, and it's about admitting it to yourself and making sure that you react to it. A lot of time is wasted trying to find that little setup tweak that will fix every problem, and it isn't there. And to be honest, it's how teams have separated themselves a little bit lately. We've always had this, or back quite a few years ago, we had this sort of technical director that was the guy at the circuit. He was the guy in the design office. He was the guy doing the whole thing. And now it's sort of separated a little bit. You've got, you know, performance guys at the track. You've got racing director, whatever you like to call it, and you've got technical directors, and that's to make sure that you're not letting yourself fall into that little grey area. It's easy if you've got control of the whole thing to think there's a little knob there that we can turn and you'll get it fixed. But I think separating it has meant that doesn't happen so often now. So you've got to make sure that you're a team of people at the track that are a different team of people that are the team of people back at the factory. You're looking for that performance. You have all the information from the aero mapping and, you know, suspension data, whatever, to get the best, get the car into its working window as such. And if you've got your car into that working window and you've analysed the data and you made sure the car's working there and it's not performing, then you've got to make sure that story goes back to those guys at the factory and you, with the problem. You know, you've it's one of those old sayings, you've got to say, you need to know everything that's wrong and nothing that's right. So it doesn't matter. If the car's good, it'll perform and it'll give you the lap time. But if it's not, you need to know what's wrong. So you need to be able to bring that message back to the guys that can fix it and make sure they believe it and get on with it. And a lot of the teams that I've seen in the past that have struggled, that I've had a little bit of involvement with, it's all been about that message. It's not been getting back. Nobody believed that there's a problem. You know, the guys back at the factory were just saying, well, the race team didn't do this right. You know, that stiffer rear anti-rollbar would have fixed everything and away you'd have gone. Not like that. But the team that believes in themselves the best and in their people and that the message that's being brought home is true and they react to it will respond the best and get on with it.
Well, that's what's going to be happening tomorrow, isn't it? There are going to be some teams who are happy, some teams who are unhappy, some who are sort of in between, not quite sure which way it's going to go. And it is going to be fascinating. We're going to be, as we said, there in force. We have Gary there. You'll be out trackside and roaming around the pit lane, making a nuisance of yourself, seeing what's going on. We'll have on audible.com live coverage, minute by minute, lap times, analysis of what's going on, tyre compounds, all that kind of thing. We'll have daily podcasts with Gary Anderson as well at the end of each day, his verdict on what he's seen. We've also got extensive video coverage as well and technical coverage from Gary, Giorgio Piola, Jake Boxall-Legg, and check our YouTube channel and motorsport.tv for our in-depth video coverage. So there's going to be plenty to talk about and plenty of ways to consume it through Autosport. So please do keep an eye out for our podcast over the next couple of days, as well as all of our other content on autosport.com. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back soon with another Autosport podcast. Music is 6 AM by Trelo, written by Marcus Simmons. See soundcloud.com/Trelo Music.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Sports Social Podcast Network.